52. To the Resurrection of the Dead. Nadia and Shakov had felt drawn to each other because neither of them was from Moscow. The Muscovites, whom Nadia met in graduate school and in laboratories, carried within themselves the poison of their imagined superiority, or what they themselves called their Moscow patriotism. However pleased her professor was with her work, in their eyes Nadia was an inferior being. She could not remain indifferent to Shchakov, who was also a provincial, but who cut his way through that milieu as an icebreaker cleaves clear water. She was in the reading room one day when a youngish senior research student, hoping to make Shchakov look small, asked him, with an arrogant toss of his snake's head, "Let me see. What locality do you come from exactly?" Shchakov, who was taller than the questioner, stared at him with bored compassion, rocking slightly on his feet. "You've never been there," he said. "It's a locality called the Front Line. I'm from a hamlet called Dugout." No man's life proceeds at an even tenor through the years. There will always be a time when he realizes himself most fully, feels most deeply, makes the greatest impression on others and on himself. All that happens afterward, however significant on the face of it, is most likely to be an abatement, the ebbing of that high tide. We never forget that time. We endlessly ring the changes on it. For some people it may even be their childhood, and they remain children all their lives. For others it is the time of first love, and it is they who have spread the myth that we love only once. There are those for whom the great time was when they were richest, most esteemed, most powerful, and they will still be mumbling without a tooth in their gums about their departed greatness. For Nyezhin the decisive period was prison, for Shchakov life at the front. Shchakov had experienced all the horrors of war. He was called up in its first month and returned to civilian life only in 1946. Through all 4 years of the war, there was hardly a morning when Shchakov could be sure he would live till evening. He never held an important staff job and was out of the front line only when in the hospital. He had retreated from Kiev in 1941 and on the Don in 1942. Even when the war was taking a turn for the better, Shchakov had to run for it in 1943 and again at Kovel in 1944. In roadside ditches, in flooded trenches, in burned-out buildings, he learned to appreciate a mess tin of soup, an hour of peace, the meaning of true friendship, and the meaning of life generally. It would be decades before the marks left on Engineer Captain Shchakov healed completely. For the present, he was incapable of dividing people into more than two categories, soldiers and the rest. Even on the streets of Moscow, where memory is short, he had kept his belief that the word soldier is the only guarantee of candor and goodwill. Experience had taught him not to trust anyone who had not undergone the ordeal by fire in battle. When the war ended, Shchakov had no family left, and the little house they had lived in had been razed to the ground by a bomb. His possessions were what he had on and a suitcase packed with booty from Germany. True, to soften the impact of civilian life, newly demobilized officers received 12 months' pay, according to rank, which was a wage for doing nothing. Like many soldiers returning from the front, Shchakov did not recognize the country he had spent 4 years defending. Young memories still preserved the mirage of equality, but at home its last pink wisps had disappeared. The country had become callous, utterly unscrupulous, and a great gulf had opened up between abject poverty and brazenly rapacious wealth. Soldiers returning from the front were, for a time at least, better men than they had been. They came back cleansed by the proximity of death, and they were hit all the harder by the changes at home, changes that had matured far from the battle zones. These veterans were all back now, walking the streets, riding in the metro, but dressed any old way so that they no longer recognized one another, and they had to accept the prevalence of the code they found here over their own, the code of the front line. A man might clutch his head and wonder what he had been fighting for. Many, in fact, asked that question, but quickly found themselves behind bars. Shchakov did not ask. He was not one of those recalcitrants who never tire in the quest for universal justice. He knew that there was no changing the course of things. You could only choose whether to jump on board or not. It was clear that nowadays the daughter of a local office-holder was destined by birth never to dirty her hands, never to work in a factory. It was impossible to imagine the secretary of a district party committee, dismissed from his job, settling for one at a factory bench. The people who set norms in industry were not those who had to fulfil them, just as those who gave the order to attack were not those who had to carry it out. None of this was new to our planet, only to a revolutionary country. The galling thing was that years of service without ever removing his boots might seem to entitle Captain Shchakov to a share in the good life he personally had helped to win, but nobody recognized this right. He had to establish his right to it all over again, in bloodless battle this time, without gunfire, without grenades. He had to fight his way through the serried ranks of bureaucracy to get his claim stamped with the seal of official approval. And through it all, he had to keep smiling. Shchakov had been in such a hurry to get to the front in 1941 that he had not troubled to complete his final year and graduate. Now, after the war, he had to catch up and struggle to obtain a higher degree. His subject was theoretical mechanics. He had thought of devoting himself entirely to it before the war. Things were easier then. He had returned to find that enthusiasm for learning anything and everything, had become an epidemic since salary scales had been adjusted sharply upward. So he had steeled himself for another long campaign. He had sold off the German booty bit by bit. He made no effort to keep up with the changing fashions in men's clothes and shoes, but defiantly went on wearing the things he was discharged in, army boots, army breeches, a coarse tunic with four rows of medal ribbons and two wound stripes. But because of this, he had not lost the allure of the wartime soldier, and it gave him in Nadia's eyes an affinity with just such another, Captain Nyergin. Nadia, who was easily hurt by any little misfortune or affront, looked up to Shchakov, with his armor-plated worldly wisdom, like a little girl, and regularly asked his advice. But even with him, she stubbornly stuck to the lie that her Gleb had been reported missing in action. Nadia had landed herself in all this, the spare cinema ticket, the playful tussle over the notebook, without realizing what was happening. This time she knew as soon as he entered the room, and while he was bandying words with Dasha, that he had only come to see her, and that something was bound to happen. And although she had just been weeping over the wreckage of her life, when she tore up the 10-ruble note she was suddenly renewed, eager to live life to the full then and there. In her heart she felt no contradiction. Shchakov, once he had mastered the emotion that his brush with her had aroused, reverted to his usual deliberate manner. He told the girl straight out that she should not count on marrying him. When she heard that he was engaged, Nadia took a few halting steps about the room, then went to stand beside him at the window, silently tracing patterns on the glass with her finger. He felt sorry for her. He would have liked to break the silence and say quite simply, with the frankness to which he had grown unused, "Poor little student, with no connections and no future, what do you have to offer me?" He had a perfect right to his piece of the cake. He would have taken it some other way if ours were not a country in which talented people are torn to pieces before they get anywhere. He felt an urge to confide in Nadia, tell her that though his fiancée lived a life of idleness, she was not hopelessly spoiled. She had a nice apartment in an expensive and exclusive building, where only top people were quartered. There was a doorman in the hall, and carpet on the stairs. Where did you ever see that in the Soviet Union nowadays? The main thing was that all his problems would be solved at once. What better way could there be? He thought all this, but said nothing. Resting her temple against the glass and looking out into the night, Nadia spoke slowly. "That's fine. You have a fiancé, and I have a husband. A husband missing in action." "No, not missing," she whispered. How rash she was, giving away her secret. "You mean you hope he's alive?" "I saw him. Today." She had given herself away, but never mind. She didn't want him to think that she was a slut, throwing herself at him. It didn't take Shchakov long to work it out. He did not assume, as a woman might, that Nadia had been deserted. He knew that missing, whereabouts unknown, nearly always referred to displaced person, and that if such a person were displaced back to the Soviet Union, it would only be to disappear behind bars. He moved closer to Nadia and took her elbow. "You saw Gleb?"
"Yes," she said, almost soundlessly, expressionlessly.
"Where is he? Inside?"
"Yes."
"So that's it," Shchukov said, as though relieved of a burden. He thought a moment, then quickly left the room. Nadia's senses were so numbed by shame and despair that she had not detected the new note in Shchukov's voice. He had run away. So what? She was glad that she had told him. Now she was alone again with her honestly born burden. The filament in the bulb was still glowing feebly. Dragging her feet as though they were too heavy for her, Nadia crossed the room, found the second cigarette in the pocket of her fur coat, reached for a box of matches, and lit up. She found some satisfaction in the nauseating harshness of the tobacco. She wasn't used to it, and it made her cough. In passing, she spotted Shchukov's overcoat lying on a chair in a shapeless heap. Imagine his rushing out like that. She had given him such a fright that he had forgotten his coat. It was very quiet, and she could hear the radio in the next room. Could hear? Yes, it was Liszt's Etude in F minor. She used to play it herself at one time when she was a girl. But had she really understood it? Her fingers had played the notes, but the word disperato, despairing, could have found no echo in her heart. Leaning her brow against the window sash, Nadia pressed the palms of her hands against the cold panes. She stood as though crucified in the black cross of the window frame. There had been one little warm spot in her life, and now there was none. But it took her only a few minutes to reconcile herself to the loss. She was her husband's wife again. She stared into the darkness, trying to make out the chimney stack of the Matryoshkaya Tishina prison. Disperato. That helpless despair, when you struggle to rise from your knees and sink back again. That importunate high D-flat, like a woman's hysterical shriek, like a cry of inconsolable suffering. The row of street lamps outside carried her eyes into the pitch darkness of a future she would rather not live to see. The etude ended, and 6 p.m. Moscow time was announced. Nadia had forgotten all about Shchukov when he suddenly came in again without knocking. He was carrying a bottle and two little glasses. "All right then, soldier's wife," he said roughly, cheerfully. "Don't let it get you down. Take hold of this glass. Keep your head and all may be well. Let's drink to the resurrection of the dead."